And there's been a deliberate practice of borrowing them from the beginning. And the early church then pretty well concluded, we discovered that the folk tunes of the people were also the same tunes that the writers who wrote heard people singing in the church services of the time, that time. And all the way down through the Reformation, and up until perhaps maybe within 200 years of our time, this has been a deliberate practice. And it used to be called an honor to have someone borrow your tune. Bach was doing it to Vivaldi all the time. Just stealing note for note tunes that the guy had written, and then using them in his own composition. Maybe giving credit, maybe not. Occasionally he'll say Fantasia on a theme of Vivaldi, but not always. So at that time it was considered an honor. Today it is plagiarism to borrow anything from anybody without giving complete credit and paying royalty. And this is considered then to be really illegitimate, this practice of borrowing in our time. Well, we could discuss that one too, so keep that in mind. The fourth thing was dealing particularly with public school music in this case. This is a known fact, finally realized by musicians who in public school, teachers, educators, that really it has been pretty disastrous what we have attempted to do with young people, especially in the elementary level. And I suspect possibly in the church too, to give them just tunes that we think are safe. That is, if they, they won't start clapping their hands and bouncing around. And also that are contrived or created by us so that we know that they are safe, and specifically in schools to teach something about music. These tunes that have been written by Richard Berg and all these characters. And as a result, these tunes come out very flat, lifeless, tasteless, colorless, and odorless. And probably contributed more than anything to what many have considered a very tasteless generation of young people today.
Give me an example of what you mean.
The American Singer, past editions of it. The new editions are quite nice. As I said, they are discovering it. Book 7 is just full of books from all over the world, but particularly from American history, telling about
American history. Did you say that you thought Richard Berg was doing a good job?
Well, he may have been converted, but most of the tunes that he wrote that I taught general music, and I went through the whole thing in college, practice teaching and so forth. And most of the tunes that he created, like my wife said this morning, when they try to get kids to sing them, they sort of groan. Because they are not particularly musical. He has written them specifically to teach something about the scale or something like that. And kids will not learn music that way. They'll learn it if they want to, and if they like it, and if there's something appealing about it. But they won't learn it like they would learn a mathematical formula or how to divide and multiply. This is for discussion. I'm just throwing it up, okay? You can bat it around. If pit area, find a variety of expressions existing. Deal specifically with the today, realizing as on this recording of the Songs of Faith Around the World that there is more than just even two or three styles or concepts of church music that exist in the world, two or three settings as we would have them in our hymn book. And there is more than just hymns and gospel songs, which are the two categories in which we tend to classify almost all church music. This is a revelation to many people, and it is an important thing to know, because there, in our shrinking world, we can learn more than just about music by realizing these varieties of culture and religious experience. I put changing role of Protestant and Roman Catholic musicians, but what it really is, as we talked about yesterday, is kind of an exchanging role. It used to be that the Roman Church was dedicated to preserving the ancient and near ancient traditions of the church, musically speaking. And the Protestantism was always kind of the light that lies ahead and to shine upon the path yet untrod. And that's what Protestantism really was at its time, at its best. But now it seems like this is being changed. Most Lutheran musicians that I know have turned into a very strong concentration on preserving the great ancient, near ancient traditions of our church, but also the Roman church. And the Roman Catholic Church in this country and in most other countries, especially Spanish speaking, have become the light that's shining upon the paths of yet untrod, because they've been forced to find a new musical expression for the vernacular, the tongue in which the Mass is being read and sung now. And as we discovered too, a lot of them are turning to the idiom of the people whom they are dealing, the Missaluba written in the Congo, for instance, strictly Congolese tunes and rhythms. And the Jalano Psalms, which we've been using here, the Magnificat and the song we sing Vespers, then last Sunday with the whole service with Jalano, these settings are not expressed as to how they are to be performed. So the Spanish-speaking countries, particularly in Latin America, Brazil, Portuguese, but they are done in the style of the people. The trumpets and guitar and flamenco style of playing used to accompany the song. And in the West Indies, where actually I learned these songs from a boy from Trinidad, and so you notice some rhythm seeping in here and there in the Magnificat at the time. Actually, a conga drum or something would have been better, but this is how I learned them. And later on, I heard them and performed them with old recorders and maybe organ, and also unaccompanied, like chant. So they can be done in most any way, depending on the place and the idiom of the people. Then the other area of music, which is really not liturgical at all, but I suppose more didactic or homiletic in nature, the use of poetic symbolism and all kinds of literary techniques in a song, satire and understatement and metaphor and all of these things that can be used in poetry and then can be use music as a vehicle to present them. And you have a type of song which to many people is quite unique and different too. I don't know what you could call it, if it has a classification or not, but a lot of the songs that we've been using these 2 weeks have been sort of like sermons in a song. Communicating ideas through this idiom
ballads, in the case of the story songs that we've been singing, and the scripture setting, but also satirical poetry and so forth. And finally, a need, a real need for less sophisticated form. See, here's gospel songs and here's hymns, the great chorale and hymns of the church. And you say, well, let's sing at camp. And you're going to decide what to sing, and here are your choices. And if the kids don't want to sing hymns out of the big red hymnal, then they've got another choice, and that is choruses and gospel songs. That's it, pretty much. But they are wondering why there isn't some other choice, and that is the reason, the real reason, how this thing holding got started. And the reason why Joe Bash got started on it, particularly. Accepted, strong, meaningful style, the folk style that the church has always used, but not really respected. It's borrowed from, but not really accepted, you might say. And using this idiom and setting good texts to them, written by good poets in our time, I've been working on some things by George Utek, and I think if I can overcome his lack of metrical feeling, why, you know, they could become pretty good songs. And Joe Bash, John Schultz, the youth staff, and many other people who are writing real good lyrics, and all they need is a tune. And they can spread into the life of the people, just like the hymns of the Reformation did, maybe. Now, I think before we get into a discussion of all these things, I'll pass off this to make sure that we don't forget about it. In the bibliography is a book by probably the most noted hymnologist in our country. I think he's a Presbyterian. I'm not sure. Presbyterian maybe. But he respects the hymnal of 1940 of the Episcopalian Church more than any other, so that's pagan. Real good, probably the most scholarly treatment of the hymn, the history of hymn, and the most uncolored by his own denominational preference, except for his liking for the hymnal of 1940, but let's face it, it's probably the best hymnal that any church has put out, so why not? Then, the Folk Song Theme Song book I read from quite a bit by Chambers. And that's probably the best book on this specific subject that there is available, and maybe the only one. I haven't found it. George Pullen Jackson. Spiritual Folk Songs of Early America. And many other books, White and Negro Spirituals of the Mountains and Uplands in certain parts of the country. He's really done a tremendous research into the folk world of the southeast of our country. And Lomax's big fat black book of folk songs is the best date of American folk music. And then there's a series of books edited by Ruth Seeger. One is American Folk Songs for Christmas, another is American Folk Songs for Children, which anybody working with children and all in church or school should have, along with Songs to Grow On and More Songs to Grow On and all these things. But the Seegers, this tremendous family of musicologists,
has produced. Pete Seeger is the son of Ruth and Charles Seeger, who were pioneers, the real pioneers in American musicology, along with John Allen Lomax. Pete has a sister, Peggy, who sings in the traditional style and has been very much responsible for the burst of enthusiasm for the real thing among young people in this country. And his brother, Mike, who started a group called the New Law City Ramblers, has been mostly responsible for the revival of interest in what you might call hillbilly or Grand Ole Opry style, but getting back further into the real traditional music, country music, you know, and string band. These guys, you couldn't believe what they do on the banjo, mandolin, and fiddle. Really perfecting the traditional styles, folk styles of the system. And this book, big red book of Christmas carols, which is quite expensive, but it's probably the best one, brand new last year. Along with other books you can find any music store. And the Clarence River Mass that we sang from a little bit. Ask for the recording of it.
Yeah.
That would be probably more easy to get. Yeah. And then talk to any priest or any of your own Catholic.
Oh, this is
Roman Catholic. French River. He's a Negro priest. But the reason I put it down is because so far, in my searching, it is the best attempt at an English folk song mass that's been made. Joseph Delano, the French Jesuit, who has done this with the Psalms, probably made the best treatment of the Psalms in this style. We'll talk a lot about them. Joe Babbage's song for today, which really should be in quantity here at Holden Village so that you could use them, because a lot of the songs in it are hard to sing unless you have all the words and the music to them. That's why they've been printed in a book. And he also had a real fine script text written to try to somehow relate between the old and the new, which he did concentrate too on in his vestal services, I think. Well, John Schultz's research book called Songs for the Small Planet, which is available from the ALC or from the National Council of Churches, has some interesting ideas in it about the ancient psalmody of the Old Testament and relating it to our time. Sing Out Publications and the company, Oak Publications, has put out all kinds of books on American and other folk ideas, folk music, folk everything, dance, literature from all over the world. Amazing company. And they were doing this at a time when it was hardly popular, and somehow they survived. And there are recordings on folkways. You couldn't believe the catalog listing that they have. It's probably the most extensive quantity of listings that any company in the world has, except that the number of records that are produced in each quantity, the quantity of records in each catalog, not listing, is so few because there isn't much demand for them. And this takes an awful lot of guts in a day when we judge everything on the basis of, is it going to sell? And if it isn't, then, you know, forget it. And in fact, even the church publishing houses operate on that. We Shall Overcome is one of the old publications of a very interesting folk process that's going on in the songs of people in integration, particularly SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinators. Edward Andrews' book on the Shakers. here, you can look at that, but that is to be had by everybody. If you want to know anything at all about this, the life of these amazing people, this would be the book to get. And the Oxford Book of Carols, which, from which Paul Christensen got his best arrangement of Christmas carols. And the guy who wrote Honest to God has also written a fine book on liturgy. John Robinson. And the Saturday Review article, from April 10th, which you can look at if you have a library handy. Nice. And then all the other masses, and you can go to a music store and find many other things. And the hymnal, service book and hymnal. Okay, on the back is just a real short listing of records, and there are so many, but these are the best. And giving you a variety of different things. From Reverend Gary Davis, who you will find very difficult to listen to at first, because he is a real bona fide Harlem street singer. But the songs that he sings are nothing but amazing. And all the way to the Robert Shaw Chorale's virtuosi arrangements of American folk hymns on this album, What Wonders Love. And Odetta's Christmas Spirituals, you will learn how to sing Go Tell It on the Mountain. And Sally Carey has recorded a whole album of sacred folk music on this album called At the Gate of Heaven. She is Roger Wagner's mistress and solo in the chorale. Now that's what I was told, so you don't hear my Okay, and all of these recordings from Folkways and Elektra, if you look at the Elektra listings, you'll get a real strong taste collection of good recordings of folk music of this country. And these names that I listed, you can look for. Okay. Now, a couple of conclusions. The first problem was raised by Howard Hahn, and that is when we started talking, I mentioned just in passing that some Presbyterians at the University of Minnesota, after having had an evening of this stuff, decided that they were going to adopt Joe Bash's Negro Spiritual Liturgy as the official liturgy of the Presbyterian Church. And herein lies the heart of the danger in this. And that is that somehow it will become officialized and canonized and dogmatized, just like everything else has become. And then that would be the beginning of the end of the whole thing. Because what it has been throughout the history of the church has been a steady gnawing influence to kind of guide and direct the church musicians so that they do not get into this realm of just trying to be so careful that they will not, offend anybody and they won't get out of line in any way. The folk, the people themselves, the laity, have always checked this tendency. And then there will be another double check, and the church will attempt to stamp out this influence. And this has been sort of a rhythm of a wave of some sort that has, you can see if you study the history of the church. Ambrose, as I mentioned, for instance, was guilty of using folk tunes, and he was put down by the church, or he would have been. Okay, so it should not become an official thing, but rather, as it is now, kind of a working underground subversive movement, which can really do an awful lot to benefit our cause, because our cause will be defeated if we stagnate it.
our music, or anything about the church. And this is to try to guard against that, to renew, continually to renew, and that's the only purpose. I remember, refer again to these two ladies walking out of church after a program, and they were complaining about how this just was not possible. What do they expect of us? Do they think we can just change overnight and, you know, do something different? And the guy walking ahead of them, overhearing them, said, "Well, I'm 51 years old, how long do I have to wait?" And this really hits the core of the thing. And if you will talk to people, I'm sure that you will discover many more people than you think who are like this 51-year-old man and have been yearning, longing for something. Not anything, but something worthy, something really good that he can use to renew his own liturgical and worship life. Why should we feel so uncomfortable with that which is strange and different? Well, it's just this old temptation, real temptation that we all have, and that is to become habitual about something and to do the same thing over and over again because we think this is good and we like it and we're comfortable in it and we don't want to be anybody to rock the boat and do things the same way. But whose fault is it really for encouraging it? And I contend that it is really the fault of the church in providing only one kind of thing, only one expression of worship. We have three settings of the liturgy, which helps a little bit, but why not 300? One for every day of the church year, of the year. Or at least 52, one for every Sunday of the church year, which could be drawn from. Not to be used a different one every single Sunday, but to be drawn from to refresh the monotony of the same service each Sunday. Oh boy, that's heretical. But one more comment. The amazing thing is that whenever we have done this, even on Sunday morning, the people, few will respond, "Well, that was different," but the majority will say very appreciatively how much they really thought about having something like this once in a while. Yeah, okay.
I'm just wondering what really is at stake here. You used the word before. What is really at stake and what's involved in renewal? Is this whole thing getting cast in the category of monotony, change? This is already in the category of boredom, isn't it? As you change because you're bored with something, and maybe it is boring. I quite agree with you. I find on that level, I find a lot of this odorless, tasteless, colorless, and it's strictly boring. But this is an aesthetic problem. Is there a problem involved in this whole business, as far as it has to do with the religious life? Is there something perhaps illegitimate about any kind of concentration here? And seriously, this is really important. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we shouldn't think of it really as adiaphora. And then there can be all kinds of change, but this great earnestness about all these different forms, and therefore they must not change. Or, on the other hand, they must change. Either way.
Yeah.
Is this really the expression of the religious life in any core sense? If it isn't, then we have freedom. If it is really intrinsic, then we've got to watch and change really perhaps is heresy.
But I'm not talking about the core of the worship experience. I'm talking about the vehicle or the expression of it. And the heart and the soul of it might be there, but people are impeded and they are, what is another good word? Yeah, the means or the vehicle for the expression is interfering with the heart and the life that may be there. Now, I'm not guaranteeing anything as far as this creating the core or the heart and the life of the congregation, because that isn't the realm that I work in. But maybe Pauline is worried more about that, and maybe you are worried more about that. But hopefully this can create an atmosphere in which this life can be expressed.
You're not saying, I don't believe either myself, that this will be the final answer here. This is something that will suit our time. Perhaps, let's say, 100 years from now, people will go to Bach, and this will be something outstanding, tremendous, and at that time, we'll put music to Bach, or let's say, maybe an extreme example, rock and roll,
Well, I mentioned already the contemporary styles, distant styles, and the jazz idiom, which Doris and I got into almost an argument this morning about. She referred to jazz in a lump term, and she was meaning just pop music, and of course that offends my sensitivity for definition, because the jazz idiom is something terribly cultured and sophisticated compared to the pop style music. And this could be, for many, many people, in time at least, as we've become educated to it, a real serious ecclesiastical expression.
Could you say that, maybe kind of punching this all together, say that you really should fit the music to the time, the music that is in vogue, at this time this is. Later on, let's say this is out of vogue, 50 years from now, then we shouldn't stick with folk music. We should do whatever is in vogue at that time.
Okay, now we're getting at the heart, but can you go any further?
I'll just say that some who have had rather conservative backgrounds, I think, feel that we can't express our deep religious experiences in a song that has only 3 or 4 chords. I mean, our whole upbringing has been based on a better type of musical culture, and so we equate this with deep religious experience. This is all confused in our background, and so this type of music, for many people, enjoyable as it is, means a superficial religious experience, whereas Bach and Handel and everybody like that means a deep, long-standing religious experience, and this is where the difficulty comes in.
And probably these people here would fit into that category more.
What we're really trying to do is get as many people interested and participating. There will be fringes who will be on the high or low side, but folk music at this time seems to gather the majority.
The people who can't throw all eggs into the hymnological tradition or the gospel song categories, but someplace else.
I think the name Bach or Handel
scares off
a good share
of
the people. If they don't know who it is, they learn it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Like Sunday night.
No one believes it, really. And it's just
right. I agree with that. And I suppose, well, okay, we'll continue.
I think having that strict form with you, people have tended to become less and less involved. And so we have a service that becomes rather ordinary to people. I mean, contrary to that thing, it's up to the ordinance and the minister, who are the master of the ceremony and the worship, to revive people. And if they just let a service be the same old thing, it's not the worship. That's why this is real place, and people are beginning to participate. And may have both ends of the other, but these people have learned to become involved in it.
And another thing is, even if they hate this with all the passion, as many have, just really, you know, without examining it perhaps, but they just violently object and they react against it negatively, it's forcing them to examine really why they react this way. And they look again at the music they say they do hold to as their music, and maybe they realize just more, much better, why they like this kind of music.
I kind of wonder if the people don't presuppose that the hymns that they've known and the church music they've known, they presuppose this is sacred music, set apart. And therefore to bring in what they would term secular, and use that in a worship service. In other words, it seems to me that they're lacking any understanding. Christ has made all things new.
Yeah, it's a gradual education in this time, as far as the wall that separates the church and the world. Of course, it's much more than just the musical aspect of it, but whole realm of social action is involved too.
Just an additional point here to what you just mentioned. In our hymnal, every hymn that I can recall has a scriptural verse that from which the hymn was formed.
Yeah.
Therefore, it makes this more sacred in a sense. We can't be otherworld, and this has to be something a little special. And I think this is where the dilemma is for many people. In relating Christ to daily living, even in the folk singing area, Pete Seeger, in some ways it might be an excellent, in other ways I think it would be detrimental to anyone who is labeled a folk singer and connected with a church.
That's why we're going down there. And it's still threatening to picket the Thursday schedule. That's when he's appearing. Now, I see that. It's a real conflict in some ways. But at least it results in making people aware of the issues and the concerns that the church has.
They must tenaciously keep something from the past rather than relating to the present. Daily living,
as we mentioned,
it was just a passing fancy that we're going through as far as folks and what's the next,
round. Yeah, but that's very legitimate, though, because as a scholar and as an academician or as someone who loves a particular thing, to try to defend it and to preserve it is, terribly illegitimate. If we deny these people their right, then we have lost a great wealth of the church's life.
Folk singing isn't new, though. This is older than the church music and the church itself. It's just sort of being revived a bit, which is really necessary, but and being brought into church, which is probably new.
I think a lot of people who, including me, who have started working in this area, have read too many books like Orwell's 1984 and Brave New World and Walden Pooh, and have reacted in this way to try to remedy a possible total mechanized society, which is what Howard Hong was getting at in both Peer Gynt and the Camus novel, that there are these two extremes, the mechanized person who is a man of habit, operates out of habitual animal-like tendencies, and then the opposite man who operates just spasmodically and kind of a what's the word? Impulse, a man of impulse. And this could be considered by many people to be an act of impulse. And so they crawl into their shells of habit and tradition and kind of mechanical Sunday morning, kind of a life. And but I think that you have to have both to kind of balance, and someplace in between, then out of this, most people will find some Lutheran middle of the road theology, someplace between the Pentecostals and the Roman Catholic. That's really what it is.
I see number seven there, communicating ideas, as the main reason that folk music exists, so to speak. It has in the past been the best meaning, I think. The words are so important in folk music, what the message is, what it says. Now, talking about Handel and Bach, and this does lift you, you get loud choruses and choirs singing these great chorales, and it does lift you kind of spiritually, but for getting a message, folk music communicates ideas, I think, better than any medium we've ever had. And I think it will continue to communicate ideas in the future. I don't think that we can say folk music is here now, like she mentioned, we've had it for a long time, and that it's going to evaporate, so that in the future maybe we'll go to jazz or something else. I think that folk music is a type of music that has existed from the beginning and will exist till the end, and that we're now just in the church dipping into this great stream of folk music and taking a little bit for the church and using it. I think that during the years we should continue to do this.
On the other hand, folk music is frequently very muddy in the ideas of communicating. Lots of words just move on. Don't mean to seem to mean much of anything. And I wonder at the same time whether communicating ideas is the primary function of music. Music is in service. Music is man's response to God. Presumably God doesn't need a great deal of information from us.
Yeah, but there's different views of music in worship, and you use music in different terms. In an evening around a campfire, it's a lot different than if you're using music at a worship service. And I say that Bach and the rest of them in the chorales are fine if you're worshiping God. And this is all you're doing. But when you're trying to communicate to man an idea about Jesus Christ, that a lot of times the idea comes much clearer in a folk music.
And you know, as long as Pete Seeger was just singing American folk songs, and trying to preserve the culture of the American folk idiom in an academic way, but then going around singing with people and singing to them, for them, then he was okay. He had escaped criticism. But as soon as he became involved in the social issues of the labor movement of the early 40s, and then it culminated in their appearing at several campaigns for Henry Wallace in 1948, then that was it. He'd had it. The whole shoot match had had it. And he's still trying to recover from this. But he isn't trying very hard. Because as the new social revolution began to... What's the word? Yeah. The problem of human rights, civil rights. And he jumped into it with both feet. And he was, for a while there, he was doing okay again. He was singing American folk songs. His recordings were primarily just interesting from a folk musicological standpoint. And then all of a sudden, a song or two would crop in about, now the 60 elections have come and gone, and I think we ought to note, in the South they've got a better way to have a fairer vote. Each voter must be literate and pass the literacy test. I think that you will all agree this method is the best. Now a southern gentleman sauntered in, and they asked, what, two and two? He answered four, and then they said, well, that's just fine for you. You're obviously literate. Your knowledge is the best. Now please go out and tell the next man to come in and take the test. The colored gentleman came in and shyly sat down, and then they really went to town. Well, he's answering 10 seconds, what's the square root of 73? He failed to answer, and thus he disproved his illiteracy. And the governor had been on a trip to Hawaii, and he'd come back, and he had a deep sun tan, and he came in, and he failed the test, and he'd never seen a more disgusted man. And, of course, you know, that's kind of funny, but then he gradually got into this world. And this is what is really, this was what got him the invitation to come to the Albany Convention on the theme, Let My People Go, because he's been so terribly involved in it. But at the same time, he's incurred tremendous criticism from the people in the church who failed to see any relationship between the church's message and these social revolutions.
I don't know a great deal about the folk music. It's just a new avenue that's really opening up to me. But after we sang We Shall Overcome last night, if that song is meant to bring people to action, I would have gone, you were like a Pied Piper to me last night. You could have led me where you wanted, and I would have wanted to go, because that song said there's only one way to respond, and that's to act, to do something about what we've sung about. And if that's what folk music, if that's the strength of the idiom of folk music, as Jerry has said here, that it is to communicate an idea that will lead to action, boy, then we need it.
You ever heard the German crawl? Dum, dum, da dum, 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 dee da dum, dum, dum. Wasn't that Hitler's theme song?
As a matter of fact, he had a bunch of songs written just for the purpose. He created a folk music.
I tried.
Yeah, well, he accomplished it to the extent that we got a record sent to us by a friend of ours who was in Germany, who felt that she was giving us a little piece of my fatherland, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think she even realized what she was saying. There's nothing but propaganda songs. But they have the ability to put people in a certain mood. I think they were successful. Well, they shared in whatever society.
And some people have said that Martin Luther was using music in this way too, by bringing it back to the people.
This isn't communicating ideas
no.
exactly, though. And I think what I was concerned about in his statement was the didactic folk song.
Yeah.
I don't think you can, in a folk song, more adequately convey, let's say, a theology or the meaning of a parable. Can't do this more accurately for folk song than you can for simple economists. But you can, I don't know what, some of the people that actually get them to see that now what they know already has implications that, I'm just concerned that we don't.
And I think it's an abortion of folk music to say that it is didactic, because it wasn't intended to be. At best, it was a passing of information from one place to another. Originally, like the walking newspaper that we talked about, because there wasn't printed words, so that the only way that news was passed was by the balladeers and minstrels and chouviers and troubadours, wherever you were from one place to another. Plus, the other aspect of it, that it is just people together singing about their common existence, their common experiences. And in fact, much of the folk literature is a communal creation. That is, it was not, somebody didn't sit down in his desk one night and decide he's going to write a folk song, but most of the time it came out of sessions like last night. That, you know, somebody would start an idea, and then somebody else would add Doris and Gene were sitting up there writing the song. And really, we all wrote the song. Nobody could take credit for its authorship. But many times there are dozens of people involved in creating a particular song. And, okay.
I think this kind of brushes against what Paul Payne was saying the other day. It kind of comes together. He was saying that the end justifies the means. And I think this is our end, we have to determine what our end is. And then does this folk music, is it justified in reaching that end? Now there will be some that will say, no, it won't. But I think it's bringing people together, and I think this leads in a good way. Also, I think that there is no illegitimate music for spreading the gospel. I think that all forms of music can be used. And maybe there'd be some that argue with me and say that this is an illegitimate way of spreading the gospel, but I think there are no illegitimate forms of music to spread the gospel.
In other words, maybe folk music is all things to all men.
More things to more men.
Yeah.
Possibly. Oh, we have, in many different ways, here in the past month, expressed the concern that there are so many people attending church who are just attending church, and they're not taking home with them a feeling of getting active, doing something about it. Often, many people who have not been trained in music can sit down and listen to it, for instance, a soloist, get up and say a beautiful piece of sacred music, and have absolutely no idea of what one word in it meant, because it is a musical masterpiece, and they have been concerned with creating the tonal implications, and the words have not come through in a way that the person who's sitting down here in the 18th pew is going to be able to pick up on a Sunday morning or a Sunday evening or Wednesday or whatever it happens to be. And I don't think that any of us have wondered about what you were singing in any of our vesper services, for instance, or Sunday morning. We have known exactly what the message was that you were putting across in song.
Yeah. Well, and like Augustine said, there were two kinds of music in the church. The one type was as a tool for the expression of the text, and where the words were important, the music was being used. And in a way, most of the music that we sing on Sunday morning is this, although sometimes we don't think about the words particularly, but theoretically the words are the master and the tune is the servant of the text. Then there is the other kind of music, and this is the kind where you don't even need words, as Augustine said. People would just sing on the they chant and sing these songs, these tunes, these melodies, and improvise on them. And you could say that this could be like the organ music, because it has no text and it is to create a feeling, a mood, aesthetic, but maybe spiritual, through the music itself, which is a servant to no one. And what about the Negro exaltations, where the words have no meaning particularly? The word amen has a meaning, but I mean, we sing it, hallelujah, we sing it as just something to intone, to use to intone this tune. And I can see really no difference between singing Amen, the Negro spiritual, and listening to a Bach choral prelude, except that in the one case you are completely involved in it, physically you are involved in it, and you are participating, you aren't just sitting there as a spectator. And on the other hand, of course, you know, it's a performance by some musician. And there is room for all of these. And maybe it's about time to wrap this up. I could conclude, you can talk more, but by saying two things. One is we gain a much deeper appreciation for the great and the old and the traditional if we can view it from many different angles. And, well, like Holden Village, somebody expressed, this is really the role of Holden Village, is to get people together up here, not just the fact of its height and its separateness, but the fact that we can study and concentrate on many different things. And that is to better objectively view the world in which we live, and so that we can see, not from being immersed in, but maybe from getting outside and looking at our problems and the church itself and the society in which we live. Well, folk music is sort of like that as far as its role present, maybe not its end and goal, but presently it serves to make people objectively look at all of their traditional music and to see if it is being threatened by this, if it can be added to and supplemented and made written rich by this, or just exactly what's going to happen to it. And folk music then itself is many different angles. And if we know this world, then we can better look at our world and all worlds from all of these different angles and perhaps gain a better appreciation for what we already have.
So that's it. And it's been all Greek choir. I hope you'll consult some of this bibliography. Maybe it will clarify a few things for you.